This is the best one I've run.
Now, is that digital to the point where you can, like, then take that? Yeah,
that would be good. There are four microphones. It does the back of the microphone.
It's a tiny little class. David's in my class.
Do you know she has a cough drop? I feel a tickle in my throat, and I was thinking maybe with her.
Well,
do you know? I might take one of those. He's got a vitamin C.
What do you have, David?
Vitamin C. Anything that's like a lozenge.
You getting a cold? Yeah, let's get started, guys. So we have time to finish this off. Any questions so far before we start talking about Leonardo Bruni? You've got his name.
City-states or communes?
They were conquered. They were taken over by lords. You know, Bruckhardt's Renaissance prince, the kind of the Della Torres, the Visconti, the Sforza, the Medici, eventually.
They were conquered,
and then they were, you have big states, Renaissance states emerge. So Italy's divided into about five large states. But they've taken over these little cities. The cities remain. The cities are still there. You can see the beautiful architecture. The cities, but they were subsumed, kind of eaten up by these big states that were led by princes. Some of the last, though, to go are Florence, 16th century, and then Venice will last, what, into the 18th century? It lasts a long time. But most of them are. And Milan had fallen to the despots very early. So Milan is a signoria, it's got a lord, and Florence is a republic. And so we get them lined up against each other here. It's like the evil empire and whatever, the good guys, okay? So it fits the mold here. Okay, Leonardo Bruni lived from 1370 to 1444. And Baron's thesis is that he was the first to present an integrated and clearly articulated doctrine of the absolute superiority of republican government to any other form of constitution, and a view as Florence as the heir to her republican freedom, to the republican freedom of ancient Rome. We've seen, though, there were precedents to this thought. It didn't just spring into his mind. But he does, it's true, he does, and several of his contemporaries do seem to be the first to consistently present this view. Now, Bruni was a self-made man like Salutati. He was born in Arezzo in modest circumstances. He rose by his sheer ability and determination to positions of prominence in the state, and he built up a sizable fortune. He caught the attention of Salutati, who promoted his career. And as I said, he was a student of Greek and became a tutor first in the Medici household. In 1405, he became secretary to the papal chancery under Innocent the VII. And then in 1410, he's back in Florence as chancellor. And then with John the 23rd, remember John the 23rd? We're in the middle of, he enticed him back to Rome, and he accompanied the Pope to the Council of Constance in 1414. But in March of 1415, he returned to Florence, where he held public office there until 1427, and he again became chancellor, a post that he held until his death in 1444. Now, Bruni, when he wrote this panegyric, was not the chancellor of Florence. He was a young man. He would have been about 20 when Gian Galeazzo declared war on Florence in May of 1390. Gian Galeazzo Visconti had made himself lord of all Lombardy. He was he was the Lord of Milan that had, through conquest, expanded that to a sizable state. He now turned, he'd done it in the north, he now turned his attention to Florence, and he began to isolate and encircle the Republic. He took Pisa to the west in 1399. Can you guys see where Pisa is there? Okay. Lucca fell soon afterwards. Next, he came from the south, capturing Siena in September of 1399. Assisi, Cortona, and Perugia to the south fell in 1400. Finally, he attacked from the north, defeating Bologna, Florence's last ally, in June of 1402. He prepared then in September to descend upon Florence. And as I said earlier, Florence was saved at that point by something of a miracle, because Gian Galeazzo died just as he was preparing to strike the city in September of 1402. And this is Baron's crisis. This is the political crisis, or the catalyst that he identifies for bringing together all these ideas in Bruni. In the aftermath of Florence's overwhelming victory over the Visconti and the dismemberment of Gian Galeazzo's empire, although his heirs would rise up and menace Florence again, but this seemed to have been a victory, Florentine pride and confidence were riding high. Bruni responded with a reappraisal of the Republic's relationship both to the contemporary situation and to the past. So why, scholars asked, did he write this? No one's paying him to do it. What do you think? He's young. He's a associate there. He's in that circle of humanists in Florence. You guys are looking at me. Are you really tired, or are you stumped?
He even protests and knows that he's not doing it to gain any popularity, but you know that's what he's doing.
That's called a ricusatio. Okay. It's a little rhetorical thing where you tell him, yeah.
But he wants notoriety.
Yeah, he wants a job, right? He has no money. He had to drop out of law school because he couldn't afford it. He wants to make a name for himself.
He wants an end to get political.
He wants to get in. And, he was looking maybe he's farsighted enough to want to replace Salutati as chancellor. He was 40 years younger than Salutati and less tied to the medieval conception of empire. He came forward at this moment to offer a new image for Florence, one intimately connected with a coherently articulated conception of republican liberty. So now let's look at the panegyric. Let's look at the text, shall we? Tell me, how'd you like it? Honestly. You didn't like it, did you?
It just went on and on. I mean, Florence is a great city, but is it really that great?
You skeptical?
It reminded me of Utopia. It's like we have Utopia.
A little too good to be true? Any other reactions to it? Yes.
I didn't really like it at first because I was thinking, okay, enough about Florence. But then I kind of took a step back and looked at it as, okay, just as we read the courtier of the perfect gentleman, this is the perfect city-state. So he's not really talking about Florence. He's talking about the government and how to put together a perfect city-state.
Good.
So then I was like, okay, it's all right now.
Good critical reading. That's good.
I thought it was enjoyable. No, I mean,
you liked it.
It kind of got boring, yeah, but like she said, you just kind of take it for what he's trying to point out about what makes perfect city-state.
We're getting kind of theoretical here, right? Good. Any other reactions to it? Yes.
Well, one of the things that I guess was missing was not so much detail, but at least some basic explanation as far as the greatness of the culture and the commerce that exists in Florence to make it so prominent. I mean, you have to have these craftsmen, you have to have this underlying community that you really didn't address to say why, we're on the rise. So
very good.
That's basically my question.
That's a good point.
What makes Florence so strong to be able to have the ability to raise armies and be able to fend off any invaders?
Very good. Maybe we'll address that. Yes, and then you. Yes.
I enjoyed looking at it from the imitation of classical encomium and praising virtue, because all of these achievements here are connected somehow to some inner virtues, and so the accomplishments and the deeds are connected to virtue. Now, he doesn't specify always which virtues they are, but that there's that connection that these people are virtuous, therefore they have
even the physical aspects of the city
right.
reflect, yeah, the virtue of the citizen. Good. Very perceptive.
I thought he was a little harsh on Florence.
I thought he was a little heavy there.
My impression was that he kind of pandered to their own sense of self-import towards his own.
Hey, he wants a job. He wants
very
a name. Good. Well, you guys read very critically. That's good. Let's look at it. I think you picked up on this is highly rhetorical, right? We don't read this at face value. This is a panegyric. This guy is spinning, right? Everything. It's written as a speech. In fact, he talks about the hearer. So picture this as a speech. Very persuasive. Mythologizing, would you say? Are we creating some myths here? I think we could agree it's designed to inculcate values. If it's not really reflecting reality, maybe it's more hortatory, right? It's encouraging Florence to become something or to see itself as something. As you know, it's modeled on Aristides' panegyric on Athens, in which the city, in which the Greek politician and general, he had been present at Marathon and Salamis, presented Athens as the savior of the Greek city-states against the Persian monarchy. So here we have Florence, savior of all of Italy, against the evil empire, right? Mm-hmm. Against the evil Visconti, the Milan. It's also modeled, I don't know how many of you read these, but it's modeled on medieval descriptions of cities. Did you think about that, David? We've read a few of those in the class.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys... sure. I don't know if you guys have... There are a lot of medieval descriptions of cities, and they are full of this exaggeration, just the same. Famous ones of Genoa and Padua. There's a famous one written about Milan in 1288. Idealized, extremely hyperbolic, just really... one line I like from the one about Milan is, I believe there are as many cities in Italy in which not as much bread is eaten by the inhabitants of both sexes as is eaten by Milanese dogs alone. How's that for impressive? Our dogs eat more bread than all the other men and women in the cities. So they kind of tend to be a little over the top sometimes. But let's look at it. Okay, you mentioned this opening, which in rhetorical, at least when I was studying Latin, we learned it's called a recusatio, which means, what is he doing in this opening? The first line, before you get to section one.
He's basically calling on God to make him sound eloquent.
Yeah.
He's not worthy to say this, but he's going to try.
His abilities do not match the greatness of his subject, right? This is completely standard. This is how they all begin. I sense here too a real zeal and a desire. He talks about desire and zeal. He's energetic. I mean, he is not apathetic about this, but he has a great desire. Here to tell us. And then he also lays out his agenda. What is his agenda? He tells us what he's going to talk about in what order. Did you pick that up at the end of the at the end of the introductory section? Mm-hmm. What are his four topics? Actually, five topics.
The
beauty and splendor of the city. He's going to give us the physical description of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Power and wealth.
Yeah, the power and wealth of the city, the history,
customs.
The customs and institutions, and that's basically how he divides up this. Now, why in this first section, why do you think he, this physical beauty and splendor, why does he praise the physical aspects? Maybe we'll get to that in a minute. Maybe tell me what, tell me, why do you think he spends a lot, is this the longest section or what? I think it may be, I didn't check it. This may be his longest section of the whole thing, is on the physical outlay of the city.
Why? That it starts I mean, from the very conception of the city, it was put on the right foot by where it was located geographically, by how the city was laid out. Obviously, we've taken our time to make it beautiful. It's just the perfect city, even from
the outside.
Yes.
Did you have a
comment? Oh, yeah, it was, you kept talking about, like, prudent outline of the city. Like, it was, like, so, like, prudently organized and made sort of, you know,
what does prudent mean to you?
It means, like, there's foresight. They're looking before, like, these people who are in the city, they have so much virtue that they can make the city so beautiful and so orderly.
I think, yeah, foresight. I like that idea. It's thoughtful. Mm-hmm. It's not haphazard.
It's clean, preserving the antiquity of the past. There's no filth.
Yeah.
None.
Yeah, what other kind of words is used to describe it? Cleanliness is a big one. Mm-hmm. You guys don't have the same page numbers I do. He talks about the cleanliness. What else?
Splendor.
Proportion. Harmony. There's a lot about this balance and symmetry, isn't there? The religious and private buildings are spread evenly throughout the city.
It has nothing that is disgusting to the eye, offensive to the nose, or filthy underfoot.
That's when you start to wonder. That's when you start to realize something's going on here. Yes. The Palazzo Vecchio. Did you notice where he talks about the city? Let's see. He talks about this palace. To be sure, in the center of the city, there is a tall and handsome palace of great beauty and remarkable workmanship. This fine building bespeaks by its very appearance and purposes for which it was constructed. Just as in a large fleet, it is an easy matter to pick out the flagship that carries the admiral, who is the leader and head over the other captains and their ships. So in Florence, everyone immediately recognizes that this palace is so immense that it must house the men who are appointed to govern the state. Indeed, it was so magnificently conceived and looms so toweringly that it dominates all the buildings nearby and its top stands out above those of the private houses. What statement does the Palazzo Vecchio make?
One of grandeur.
And?
Power.
Power? What kind of power?
Government.
The power of the government over, what does he say, the private houses? So we have public over private here. Public power dominates the private sector. He gets concentric with it too, doesn't he? The symmetry. Did you pick up on that?
Yeah, it almost kind of, the way he described it, it was almost like a rose. It was kind of like, here's this, and then the next layer, and then the next layer, and then.
He used a buckler, didn't he?
Yeah,
like a shield, right? Is that right? Is that what a buckler is?
It is. It's small.
Yeah. Okay. So why that image?
Well, I mean, I remember why he was using it to say it's just like layer upon layer upon layer of excellence.
So it's the big center, the city, it's
the boss in the middle, and then. But he's talking about it as a kind of a fortified defense, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So a shield is very apt. Image for this city and its concentric organization and how it can stand that well. Why is he so interested in the physical aspect of the city?
Well, it also deals with Florence's ability to maintain this splendor forever. As he says on page 145, the first employer of the laws and the perfect location of the city is you're at a certain distance from the sea where you're not going to be invaded.
Yes.
At the same time, so long you have waterway, you have some connection primarily for commerce, so you know you can have an easy flowing of money, but you don't have an immediate influx of different influences of people or politics or whatever to change the character of the city.
What's he actually doing there, though? That's part of his argument. He's dealing with the one defect of Florence, isn't he?
They're being threatened.
Being so far from
Florence has one defect, which is
no waterway, no.
They're not a port city. And in Italy, I mean, Genoa was hugely wealthy. You know, they got involved in the Crusades. They made a lot of money. Venice, hugely wealthy because they were on the port city. So the one thing Florence lacks is a port, but he has this elaborate
argument
for why she sits right in the middle of Italy. Queen of Italy, he calls her, positioned right there. So that's interesting. That's his attempt to kind of talk us out of the idea that maybe Florence has a defect.
Didn't you say this was written right after the time where the I forget his name.
John Galeazzo.
Was going to invade and failed, so wouldn't it be like, I mean, even if he would have attempted, Florence is so perfectly positioned, it would have been impossible to do so. And
In fact, I think that's why he starts, that's one of the reasons he tells us about the physical aspects of the city. If you look on the bottom of page 142, he tells us why he's praising these aspects. How a single city could muster the great number of troops and immense resources, not to mention the vast amount of money needed for the war. But this wonder, the great amazement, I'm on 143, the great amazement of everyone lasts only as long as men have not seen this beautiful city, nor observed its magnificence. I think you also mentioned it's a reflection of the virtue of the people, the prudence of the people, the perfection, the cleanliness, the harmony of the people. But that's one reason he focuses on the physical, is to explain their victory against John Galeazzo. Yes?
I just had a question. There's this one, like, phrase, like, comparison he uses that I just thought was kind of strange.
Yeah?
It was, like, bottom of page 140 or so. It's like, he says, it's right before the flagship analogy and the admiral thing.
Yeah?
He says, hence, just as blood is spread throughout the entire body, so fine architecture and decoration are diffused through the whole city. I mean,
that's
I
great.
The whole diffusion analogy, but I'm wondering, I mean, it's strange. What I was wondering is there something else to be said for that analogy, too? Because
yeah.
Like, blood is, like life-giving, so we could be saying in a certain sense that, like, the beauty of the architecture and decoration in some sense, like shows the life of the city or gives life to the city. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know what? When I hear that, I think as in medieval parlance, you're talking about a corporation, a body. Medieval cities and guilds are they're called corporations because they're often talked about as bodies. Each member, a part of the body, making it function with a head. It's really common in medieval political thought, and I think that's where it comes from. This analogy to a city, but it's a corporate image. It's not people subject to a ruler. It's every part working harmoniously together to create a city, a healthy city. I hadn't noticed that corporate imagery in there. That's good. That's good. Okay, good. And then, so he's dealing with this one admitted defect. He does admit it's a defect, but you guys, as you pointed out, in fact, it has advantages because of the negatives of seaside living. And it's positioned equidistant from the Tyrrhenian and the Adriatic seas, so it can be utilized both coasts. But really what we have here are some specious arguments, and again, reminding us that this is really oratory. This is not reality. This guy's making the best arguments he can to bolster Florence, to give an image to Florence, to encourage the Florentines to kind of be what they can be. How about I want to give plenty of time here. Any other questions about the physical aspects? Very interesting. Yes.
I was going back to the issue of blood. Done on two levels. One is blood, so the tears you put into the buildings, and also it's the lineage of those who, the generations it took to build those buildings, have always been in Florence. I mean, they're not nomads. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thought too. There's a lot of imagery of family and lineage here in it, too, and that's a good point. Good. So we move on to the power and the wealth of Florence. It gets kind of interesting here. What kind of claims does he put forth in the section on the power and the wealth?
Well, that they're from Rome, but from Rome, when Rome was at its height of its republic and the best Rome it was ever, was when Florence was founded. And so, I mean, Florence kind of almost got imbued with that sense of power. And
well, they're heirs. Again, we get back to this family imagery that was mentioned here. They are the direct heirs of Romans, but not just any Romans. Which Romans?
The Republican.
The Republican. In fact, doesn't he say, talking about an heir, it matters, the status of the father affects the heir. So if he's a king, then the heir is inherits that power. And so just
and
as...
It's the timing, too.
Right, right. Just as Florence is established during the Republic, so it receives all those Republican virtues from its ancestors. And this is about the time the humanists had just discovered that Florence was founded by Sulla's veterans in about 100 BC. So they just found out that, indeed, it was the Republic, an alien Republic, but the Republic still. And so from this, they argue for virtues, right, mm-hmm. inherited from this Republican parent, ancestor. What else? What else comes with this heritage?
The whole world.
Yeah, you got it.
The entire world.
The right to dominate the whole world.
Possession of your parental legacy.
What page are you on?
150.
Yep.
About halfway down.
Okay. Yeah. So, therefore, to you also, men of Florence, belongs by hereditary right dominion over the entire world and possession of your parental legacy. What follows is interesting. So what does he say following that? From this it follows that what?
All wars are just, that the Florentines wage.
Because?
Everything is defense. Or
they're either defending themselves or they're recovering what belongs to them already. That's convenient. That's good. Got it. That's, you think, how could he be serious when he's writing that? But there. He says it. And it's interesting to note that this imperialist, really it's kind of an imperialist view of Florence, is understandable. In this brief period between 1402 and the conquest of Pisa in 1406 was probably the one moment when Florence exercised more power in Italy than at any other time in her history. The Milanese Empire had collapsed, albeit temporarily, but for the time being. The Papal States was in a shambles because of the schism. Genoa was racked by civil war, and only Venice remained a serious rival, but Venice was not seriously looking at the terra firma. She was still focused outward. So at this moment in time, Florence seemed to be on the brink of realizing these kind of pretensions, these kind of imperial pretensions. Now, you understand when we say imperial, Rome gained most of its empire, the core of it, under the Republic. Okay, you remember that? By the time the emperors come along, they have Spain, they have North Africa, they have Greece, they have Gaul. It's so the empire is acquired by the Republic, okay, just to clarify that. Okay, so it follows then that all wars are just because they're either defending or recovering their own territory. And they have always, he says, been united against the invaders of the Roman state, which is not true. At various times, the Pope had called in, and sometimes on their own initiative, various emperors had come from the Holy Roman Empire into Italy to do their will, and sometimes Florentines supported those. Dante was hoping things would work out with one of those emperors, so... that is patently not true. We'll do some more fact-checking in a minute, though. Florence was founded, and then what other kind of points does he make from this this assertion that Florence is founded under the Republic?
They're enemies of tyranny?
Mm-hmm. They're always enemies of tyranny, but we know that's not always true. How about on 151? He makes kind of an interesting assertion.
Men are only able to do like important things.
Where is it? Say that again.
On page one, it says, so that such moments in history, great men are able to do only what is important and glorious, and what is accomplished then is always especially outstanding.
Yeah, that's it. That's a very significant line. He says, prosperous times stimulate men's minds and call forth great spirits. So that such moments in history, great men are able to do only what is important and glorious, and what is accomplished then is always especially outstanding. What has he said?
That this is a great time.
This is an interesting historical explanation of the Renaissance, isn't it? that freedom calls forth greatness. The freedom of the Republic allows men to be the greatest they can be. He goes on and talks about the rise of the emperors. And what does he say? What does he think about that? What does he call them?
Underminers of the Roman Republic.
Yes. The Caesars, the Antonines, the Tiberiuses, the Neros, those plagues and destroyers of the Roman Republic before they had deprived the people of their liberty. And he suggests, I'm looking on page 154, he quotes Tacitus. Did you notice that paragraph right before the closing of the section on the power and wealth of the Romans? He said, I want to show that Florence has not without good cause developed its political allegiances, and second, to make it understood that at the time when Florence was founded, the city of Rome flourished greatly in power, liberty, genius, and especially with great citizens. Now, after the Republic had been subjected to the power of a single head, those outstanding minds vanished. He's quoting Tacitus. So it is of importance whether a colony was founded at a later date, since by then all the virtue and nobility of the Romans had been destroyed. Nothing great or outstanding could be conveyed by those who left the city. So under the emperors, what happens to the genius of Rome? It dies. You know, it's not unlike, really, the Greeks, didn't they believe that people that lived under empires and kings were just slaves and barbarians? Only free people, free people like themselves truly expressed and fulfilled their human, full human capacity. So this is very interesting. He's saying that republicanism engenders genius, creativity, great minds, and that imperial despotism squelches that. And all right, how about history? Any other comments on what on that section on the power and the wealth? How about the section on history? This one is interesting. We don't get too far into it. Well, what does he say? Let's kind of take it as it comes here. As you read it, what caught your eye? What did you mark as you read it?
They uphold the rights of the weaker, always.
Always.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
It didn't only strive to be wealthy, it sought to promote its industry and magnificence even more.
Even in war. Good. Talks in kind of general terms, doesn't he, about the Florentine history. When we get to page 156, he gets into something. What's he doing here? Before I come to this topic, I think it would be appropriate and advisable for me to explain something and alert the reader, lest anyone, having gotten a false impression, might condemn me for being rash or ignorant. Do you notice that section? Did you wonder what was going on? The former derives from levity, the latter from stupidity, and both are to be avoided. Now, I do not doubt that a good many foolish men will suspect me and think that I wish with this my panegyric to win the good graces of popular acclaim. What have you mentioned that before, right? Mm-hmm. That I want to curry favor with the mob, that I'm trying to capture men's minds as much as possible. Thinking this way, they believe that I have overstepped the bounds of truth and am embellishing my speech, that in embellishing my speech I have mixed the false with the true. You think that's what he's done? Mm-hmm. He has, hasn't he? So what's he doing here? Do you think he knows that we know? Who votes for that?
Hoping we don't.
Great politicians do.
I think he knows that we know, don't you?
That maybe by admitting that he's doing that, we'll believe more of him or we'll want to.
Or is his tongue in his cheek? I don't know.
All he's giving is just rhetoric. There's no real taste.
There's no substance to it?
Might as well just keep on going with it, right? Make sure everybody's still with you.
I think we're getting a little wink from him here. I think he knows that we know that... He is embellishing, in fact. He says, my panegyric will make me an enemy of all those who are envious of or hostile to Florence, and all those men who have ever been troubled, beaten, or conquered by the Florentines, or whose forebears were so affected. All these men will hate me because they'll see that maybe he isn't being entirely truthful. And then he says some other interesting things to preface his remarks about specific historical events. Still, on page 157, there will be still others who either because of the baseness of their natures or their ignorance of the subject matter will hold nothing to be true except what accords with their self-interest. Okay, then if they don't agree with me, it's just because their self-interest. These men will accuse me of vanity and will bring charges that I have written nothing that is genuine, which we're going to do in just a minute. I am not talking, skipping down, he said, To these I say, they should not try to treat me cunningly, nor hasten to accuse me rashly. Rather, they should always realize that their views are reprehensible and should especially remember that I am not talking about the virtue or excellence of individual citizens, but about the entire community. Indeed, if one or another citizen in Florence has lapsed into some small sin, this is no good reason to reprove and culminate the entire city. Especially since in Florence, this is a significant line. The deeds of evil citizens are not imitated, but are criticized and corrected. Indeed, no city has ever been so well governed and established that it was completely without evil men. Skipping down, now there are both public and private crimes, and there is a great difference between the two. A private crime derives from the intentions of the individual wrongdoer. The public ones are the result of the will of the entire city. In Florence, I'm skipping down again a few lines. In Florence, it has always happened that the majority view has been identical with the best citizens. Is that very realistic?
No.
Especially if you know the history of Florence, or the history of any commune. Exile. They're always... factional strife and exile. Florence had the same problems that the other communes did. So here he seems to be denying that fact and saying always, how does he put that?
Always.
In Florence, it has always happened that the majority view has been identical with the best citizens. What are the best citizens? Well, no, we'll talk about that in a minute. What's happening politically in Florence actually is the broad-based guild government is being replaced by a much smaller group of ruling elite. Florence is moving toward oligarchy at this point, and eventually, because of financial straits, will fall into the hands of the Medici, and they will be ruled entirely by one family. But at this point, Florence is moving away from a broad-based medieval kind of corporate government that includes a broad cross-section of citizens into one where the upper-class guildsmen have allied more with the elites and are cutting out the lower classes in the government of the commune. So this is a government of consensus rather than active participation and inclusion. So identifying, he can say that Florence is virtuous because as a whole they are, and because the will, one more time, he says, it has always happened that the majority view has been identical with the best citizens. This history, he begins then with kind of a general treatment. right? Florence welcomes exiles, 159, which is really interesting. Again, if you know Florentine history, a lot of exiles floating around, you know? A lot of Florentine exiles floating around Italy. That they're good to other city-states, as you pointed out. They settle disputes. They aid the weaker parties. They're faithful to their allies. Then he begins to talk about specific historical events. Did you notice? He's starting to get specific. We are, let's see, on page 162. How does he describe Florentine behavior in the face of Henry VII, who was called down into Italy to quell things? He's the Holy Roman Emperor.
Did the citizens scared him because they just went about their business as he sat outside the gate?
Yes.
So they gave up his siege.
Yeah.
Nor even Hannibal approached the Porta Colina in Rome with more hostile intentions than did this monster plan his assault before the walls of Florence, but he gave up the siege. Should we do a fact check there? later in life, Bruni wrote what has been called one of the first modern histories, History of the Florentine People. He wrote at the end of his life. And even there, it was begun in 1415, he tells a different story. Actually, Florence did not do this on its own. Its allies are responsible for Henry's withdrawal. So even he knows here that he's not. And people alive reading this, know that this isn't what happened. How about about Volterra, the next story we hear? The attack against Volterra. Bottom page 163. The Florentines defeat Volterra. It's a city on a high hill, so they're at the disadvantage. They come up the hill, they beat the people of Volterra in 1254, overcome by great valor. Another fact check. Again, in his history, the version is considerably less heroic. And one reader wrote in the margin of his copy, "Everything the order says here about Volterra is totally false and entirely contrary to the truth of the matter. The Florentines did not capture the city of Volterra at that time by their strength, but by fraud and deceit, since treaties had been entered into, which then in those times were violated. Nor did the Florentines get possession of the city by physical courage, but rather owing to the betrayal, baseness, and poverty of the Volterrans and the Florentines' power, standing, and wealth." So at least that person did not agree at all with the way he portrayed Volterra. Now we get to the interesting one. This is Florence in the face of John Galeazzo on page 166. This is kind of his high point. This is his Florence versus Milan. No mention here of a sudden death by the plague, is there? No. It's completely Florentine virtue, unity, valor. Fact check, Florence's last battle with John Galeazzo outside Bologna, June 26, 1402, a crushing defeat for the Florentines and their Bolognese allies. So John Galeazzo took Bologna at that time, but Florence was backing a tyrant in Bologna. So John Galeazzo deposed the Florentine-backed tyrant. A free commune was established with the support of John Galeazzo, and then they chose him as their lord. So a little more complicated. And then he continues with this idea. Florence has always opposed, on 166, the aggressor. So it has always been clear to everyone that Florence treated these states as its own homeland and fought for their liberty, for the liberty of all Italy. Again, kind of an echo of these imperial pretensions. And again, on that page, the whole of Italy has been liberated from the yoke of servitude by Florence on more than one occasion. Florence is the defender of republican liberty. Let's look quickly at the Constitution. I want to get to the life of Dante before we expire here. Section 4, you read about the Florentine Constitution. What adjectives kind of come up again and again, especially in that opening paragraph? 168. What? Justice, harmony. You hear a lot of harmony. Internal order, neatness, harmonious cooperation, a harmonious constitution, justice. And then he describes the Florentine Constitution. Could you follow that? It's actually quite a hodgepodge of offices and magistrates and councils and this many and that many. It's almost, to me, it's almost an intentional, it's almost in jest. Harmonious, neat, ordered constitution. And then the reality is this layering of, since communal times, of one council on top of another and a magistrate. It's not harmonious. I mean, it works, but it's not neat in, by any sense of the word. And as I read that, I mean, and I got to tell you, I've studied Florentine history, but still the Constitution kind of leaves me like this when I have to read about and understand exactly how it worked. Many layers, many councils, a lot of traditions. And then the Parte Guelfa, the Guelph Party. And again, you kind of wonder what's really going on there. He compares it to the censors of Rome who oversee the Constitution, but there could be a very dark side to that too, ensuring the consistency and the kind of an ominous sense to the Parte Guelfa. And then he talks about equality and politics and before the law. And again, a fact check. As I said before, by the time Bruni is writing this about the Florentine Constitution, so harmonious, so such a consensus, Florence was in fact moving away from a broad-based guild republicanism of the earlier popular government. In 1378 to 82, it was the most broadly based government Florence had ever had. There was a revolt of the Ciampi, who were the very lowest wool workers. They did the most menial work. And they demanded a role in government, and they got it. It was a scary, scary time for the elites. In fact, they said they would rather be subject to King Ladislaus of Naples than to be subject to those Ciampi again. So the elites did not like it. And they feared that. And at this time, actually, Florence is moving back away from the broad popular government. The upper guildsmen are moving toward the elite and leaving these lower classes behind. And what's happened is there were political reforms in the 1380s and 90s that had eliminated these artisan and working classes from any significant role in communal government. The non-elite, the wealthy major guildsmen, were included collectively in large numbers in the government, but they actually only held high office very infrequently. And the Florentines controlled this, by the way, they scrutinized the elections. You had to get on a list to even run for the highest offices. And then they would manipulate the names. They would draw lots. It wasn't a direct voting, as even among, you know, the Greeks did this too. It's kind of, I guess, to let fate have a hand in politics. But they would draw names out of purses, Borsellini, little purses. And they would manipulate the names in the purses. So they kept control over who would actually have the highest office. And it became a very small group. You never did? It's called oligarchy. You know, but if you think about it, the Roman Republic was that way too. There was a very small group of families that ran the Republic. Okay, so anyway, Florence was doing, they were manipulating the election. So although the upper wealthy guildsmen did have a large collective role in government, in fact, they had less of a chance of holding high political office. So they exchanged any real power for some power. Okay, and it gets even worse with the Medici because they have to maintain the facade of the Republic. But this is going on at the time that Bruni is writing this about this consensus. And you were saying at the back, you in the black shirt, said, why don't they talk about the people who make this great? Well, these people are being lumped as a consensus of whose virtue is always identical with that of the best men. He finally ends up, I don't know if you noticed this too, comparing Florence to a family. Let's see. At the very end. Oh, page 173. Under these magistrates, the city has been governed with such diligence and competence that one could not find better discipline even in a household ruled by a solicitous father. This is a patriarchal or patrilineal. And again, it ties in with the Roman heritage, our virtue coming from who our fathers were. As a result, no one here has ever suffered any harm, and no one has ever had to alienate any property except when we wanted to. The judges and the magistrates are always on duty. The courts, even to the highest tribunal, is open. All classes of men can be brought to trial. Laws are made prudently for the common good, and they are fashioned to help the citizens. There is no place on earth where there is greater justice open equally to everyone. Nowhere else does freedom grow so vigorously, and nowhere else are rich and poor alike treated with equality. So we have a model of a family as a government. So the elders rule for the good of the lesser. So we have here an ethic of kind of a dutiful passivity. And Najemy argues, I think it's true. He's legitimizing here a new oligarchic republicanism in which good citizens of the populo respected their betters within the elite. He is the civic humanist insistence of the Roman origins of Florentine Republican are merged then with the sense of the Republic as a patrilineal family in which the elders shape the citizens' sons in their own image. Now, there's a reason that Bruni was able to bring these ideas together. It's late, so we don't have time to go into all the details. It's interesting that he ends this again with an appeal to oratory and humanistic studies, if you look at that. He's able to synthesize these ideas, which had remained disparate in Salutati's work, and to maintain a consistency in presenting his Republican views, because first, one reason is he knew Tacitus, and Salutati didn't. Tacitus is a second century Roman historian who did not like the empire. He's very critical of the empire, and he describes the debaucheries and the baseness of the emperors in great detail. So Bruni knew this. It's fuel. It leads him in that direction. Salutati didn't know this historian until the end of his life. And also, it's this change in the Florentine political life that was in progress from 1382 when this broadly based guild republic collapsed, and especially after 1393 when those wishing for more restrictive participation triumphed. And also looking outward, as we mentioned earlier, this changed role of Florence in international politics, when she seemed to be on the top of the heap between 1402 and 1406 and had no real rivals in Italy. So how could he say these things? What do we make of him? How could he distort and exaggerate? And he knows that he is, and he knows that we know that he is. What's going on here?
Pride.
His pride?
Well, the pride.
He's trying to engender pride?
Yeah.
Is this hortatory? Is this an encouragement? What do you think? There's a famous letter that he wrote to the Archbishop of Milan, his old friend, in 1440. Listen what he says. The oration was written when I was young, fresh out of Greek class. It was a boyish trifle, a rhetorical exercise. The rhetorical genre and panegyrics of this kind calls for boastfulness and winning applause. In civic panegyric, the speech is directed to those whom you wish to praise. The genre demands an audience and brings together a multitude of people, not for the purpose of hearing legal cases or deciding on public policy, which is where you'd have to be truthful, but in order to reap the applause and pleasure from hearing its own praises sung. History is one thing, panegyric another. History must follow the truth. Panegyric extols many things above the truth. What do you think?
It's kind of like the city's Chamber of Commerce.
You got to remember, Bruni's working in a tradition where Quintilian, a great ancient rhetorician, he says, when praising, it's appropriate to amplify and embellish the subject. Think he's done that? I think so.
Yes.
He's a great rhetorician. James Hankins, he teaches at Harvard, and he's written a lot about this. He says, Bruni's goal was to arouse patriotism and the generous emulation of virtue. He was both a civic humanist and a professional rhetorician. Rhetoric was merely a tool to achieve his ends. think he's just encouraging them, giving them a dream, telling them what they can be instead of what they are.
This is the ideal that they should be living up to.
That's the job of it. Isn't that what Petrarch says the job of oratory is? Mm-hmm. Eloquence? So maybe he's not such a creep, huh? And then Jamie, of course, would say this is more than just fluff. In the case of Florentine politics, it's not a restatement of the central values of popular republicanism of this earlier time, this broadly popular of the 13th and 14th centuries, but it's a new ideology that provided cultural, education, historical, and moral buttressing for both the newly established hegemony of Florence's elite families and for the subordinate political and social status to which the middle class had been relegated. So he said this. He says this actually reflects what was going on, and he's justifying it. Finally, we have just a few minutes. Let's look at that life of Dante, which seems to support this reading of the panegyric. Did you like that little life?
Yeah.
Short, written in 1436. Here we have kind of the same ideal of virtuous citizenship. What did Bruni think of Dante's life? I mean, Boccaccio's life that he'd written. He tells you in the proem. Did he like that little life?
No.
No?
He left a lot of holes out. I mean, it was kind of like...
Yeah. Did he like the way that Boccaccio made Dante look? What did he make him look like?
I forget how he said it.
It's true. If you read the life, it's exactly what it is. It's like a soap opera. My gosh, the guy's just always in love or some kind of emotional turmoil. It focuses on certainly not the important things, according to Bruni. He's written it as he was writing the fiction. It's filled with love and sighs and burning tears, as though a man were born into this world for no other purpose. Well, Bruni's going to change that. He's going to write about Dante, the good, solid citizen of the Republic, right? So what do you get in that life of Dante? The pre-exile Dante. What's all the stuff he does that a virtuous citizen should be doing?
He serves in the military.
Right?
He gets married. He has children.
He works in the government.
Yes, and he's not a recluse. He makes that point a couple of times. This great poet does not sit in his ivory tower. I think 83 and 84, he talks about that. Makes a real point. Just what a humanist would do, a civic humanist, right? And he points out to us, moreover, Cicero, Varro, and Seneca, all consummate Latin philosophers had wives and held offices of government in the Republic. So Boccaccio may pardon me for his judgments on this matter are both false and feeble. He says, man, according to all the philosophers, is a social animal, and Dante lived in the world. He was not a recluse. The problem with making Dante a virtuous citizen is what?
His life, right? He gets kicked out.
Yeah. Yeah, he was kicked out, and he's angry about it the rest of his life, right? He never does come back to Florence. He dies in Ravenna. So, let's look at Dante in exile. How does Bruni deal with Dante the angry exile? This is like all of it's on page 89. This is so short. It's like a lot easier to handle. 89. Dante's exiled, and you read about the story. You know, there's kind of a specious law they pass so they can accuse him of things he's already done, but he's not there to defend himself, so he's automatically guilty, so they kick him out.
Oh, he tries to be humble. So.
At first, what is... Yeah, exactly.
Bruni kind of makes Dante a victim.
Yeah,
he endeavored by good deeds and upright conduct to obtain the favor of returning to Florence, like he should have. He should acquiesce. He should submit himself to the powers that are there. But what happens? Does he maintain this posture of submission to gain the favor of the government? What does he do?
He makes a political move and it goes the wrong way for him.
He pins his hope on
Charles IV.
This is actually Henry of Luxembourg coming down.
Henry.
Yep. He pins his hope on Henry, the Emperor Henry VII. And he he begins to speak evil of the leaders of the state, right? And so even though he was a victim, kind of an unjustly accused victim, kind of does it to himself, doesn't he? Because he doesn't just acquiesce and submit and try and be good and hope they'll let him back in. On page 90, he himself had destroyed all chance of pardon by speaking and writing against the citizens in power. And no force remained whereon he could place further assurance. So Bruni puts the blame squarely on Dante for turning an unjust sentence into exile. So this kind of becomes a cautionary tale, doesn't it? Good citizens control their passions and exercise self-discipline and submit with consensus and sociability. Okay, we're almost done here. Within a decade, what's really interesting is that within a decade, the leaders of the regime would come to accept Bruni's Republican version of history and politics as their own. Another writer, he wrote in the 60s and 70s by the name of Jean Brucker, was another Florentine historian. He went back. Another reason people love Florence is that there are volumes and volumes and rooms of documentation from the medieval to the Renaissance period. You can work in the archives of Florence, like everyone works in the archives of Florence, to go do their research, because they kept copious notes on everything, and they kept notes on the consulte and practice, which were these deliberative councils that the elite leaders would sit down and kind of talk about policy. They kept these records, and Brucker went in and read them for this period. About 10 years after the panegyric, he started seeing in the records, and these are not humanists, they're just, they're elite, they might have had a humanist education, but they're politicians. He begins to see specific references in the consulte and practice to specific classical authors and sources. So as they're deliberating about the policies of the city, they're quoting Cicero and Cato and Livy and Caesar and Sallust. And again, these aren't just humanists. These are, well, they're Florentine elite, but they're the ruling class. Which suggests to him that they had adopted this idea that a knowledge of the past was seen as a most important element in analyzing the current problems and predicting the future. They were also citing Florentine history, too. And he argues that this humanist principle had moved from the private study of the scholar to the political arena. But the difference was, rather than spokesmen for their corporations, as in the old guild government, empowered by their constituency, these speakers regarded their discourse as, they regarded themselves as individuals formulating independent opinions, empowered by their eloquence. Very different. Instead of a representative empowered by his constituent, we have an individual empowered by his eloquence as they sat to make decisions for Florence. Florence was an elitist, consensus-based polity. Now, Pocock and others, Skinners and others, have suggested that Bruni's humanism is transmitted through Machiavelli to the Atlantic and comes into Republican tradition there. But I think everyone, some of that's questionable, but I think everyone agrees pretty much that the great heir to the civic humanism was Niccolo Machiavelli, and it's so perfect that you're going to hear about Machiavelli next week. So I brought you right up to the point here. But Machiavelli was a historian and not an orator. These are things to remember. I think Bruni is principally an orator, and he'll sacrifice history if he has to make his point. Machiavelli preferred to talk about how one lives rather than how one should live. He's kind of negative, okay? I'm just preparing you for next week. Kind of a negative guy. Instead of associating the ancients with the moderns, he contrasts them and finds the ancients strong and the moderns weak. For Bruni, man is moved by virtue. For Machiavelli, by necessity. But in the end, you can't blame Machiavelli for being a little bitter, because he was a Republican without a republic. It was gone by the time he came along, and he only, and actually because he briefly joined the Republic when the Medici came back, he was in the cold, and he could only stand on the outside and look in. Where he talks about his letters having conversations with the ancients in his study because there's no room for him in the public forum anymore. He's bitter, but I think he has reason to be. As the Italian republics passed into the control of despotic governments, and as Florence finally did in the 16th century, the civic humanist was replaced by the courtier, which you have learned about a couple weeks ago. That's where all the learning and the refinement goes, to the court, not to any kind of civic participation. Humanists worked at despotic courts to create propaganda and embellish and glorify their princes. Or humanism went that way, or it became the preserve again of the academic specialist. That's civic humanism. Do you guys have any questions? Yes. Will you kill someone? A roast?
Yeah, there is an opposite. It's a battle tribe or
vituperation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a rhetorical opposite, all right, and you display exactly the same sorts of techniques, except you do them in reverse. So you also play loose with the facts. And have we heard this before?
That's a good question.
Yeah, but there's also one other odd rhetorical form that you get in the Renaissance, but you got all the way back to antiquity, and that's the mocking comedy, where you praise something for the wrong reasons. And that's more subtle than the vituperation or diatribe.
More entertaining.
Yeah. There's a famous one by Berni, one of the early 16th century playing poets, which is in praise of the play. And another one in praise of Baldwin.
That humanism took in some places because there were humanists working for the despots at the same time that they're working in the republics. It's just an application, a practical application of humanism in that direction.
So it's by that, when it goes to the north, it's in a totally different direction.
Christianized.
As we'll see.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me. You might start reading chapter 3 of Malachi. After chapter 3, then he goes into the northern.
We lost video, but we got audio.
Yeah, you know what I think is happening? I think it's recording to the internal memory instead of the
external. Like it's not to the card.
Yeah, I'll have to check that tonight because I've got to do Mark Helper tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Here's this old deal.
Yeah.
Oh, can I have a copy of each of those?
Yeah,
I'll put them
the
on
there. This is just the beginning of the. I didn't.
Yeah, I don't put this.
It's a long one, but yeah. This is just an excerpt.
I'll put them
make
on.
The point. Okay.
Yeah, I'll put them on the.
Yeah,
the blackboard
we report
for the,
to refer to them.
For
yeah.
The people in.
Tell you about, and then you
what
go.
What's the name of that?
Because
he does that too.
Yes.
I'm not
going to
mention this.
There's Captatio Benevolentia, which is not that. It's.